This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to tonight's show. Tonight is the first of a three-part interview with Jeff Ritzman, talking about his very strange experiences. And a couple quick notes before we get into that. We're still collecting listener stories, so go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And under the contact section, you can find a link for stories. Send us your stories. We'll either have you tell them on the air or we'll read them on the air, depending on which you would prefer. The other thing of note is that myself, Joshua Cutchin, and Michael Hughes will all be at FortFest 2016 next weekend. We're all appearing on Sunday. The event goes Saturday and Sunday. We're all on Sunday. Things kick off around noonish, I believe. I'll be talking about some of my experiences with some photographic stuff so you can see where different things happened. It should be nice and weird. Josh will be talking about his book, A Trojan Feast, Incidences of Food in the Paranormal, and Mike will be doing a talk on tarot cards. So it should be a good time. And any of you listening who are going to be there, please come up and introduce yourself. So for now, we're going to hear this interview with Jeff Ritzman. This is a really weird story. I had to break it into three parts. If you're a patron, you got all three parts already. I put them up already for patrons only, and there'll be an extra segment for patrons as well. Jeff is the host of Paratopia Oculus currently, formerly the host of Paratopia and a bunch of other stuff, which we'll get into here at the beginning. And throughout his life, he's had some very high strangeness type of stuff going on. We discuss this. We discuss some of the projects he's done in the past and the current one that he's working on. I plan on airing part two next weekend, and part three may end up being a midweek so I can make room for other people that we have coming on the show so this doesn't go 3 weeks long. Again, patrons get the whole thing at once. Otherwise, you can wait and pick it up over the next 2 weeks. So here we go. Part one of the interview with Jeff Ritzman. And my guest tonight is Jeff Ritzman. And how are you doing tonight, Jeff?
Good, sir. How are you?
I am great. And you have some really interesting stuff going on. And first of all, tell people, you do your own podcast.
I do.
And you've done some in the past. You want to give people a little podcast history?
Oh, wow. Second Eclipse was my first podcast. That was like back in the infancy days of podcasting. And I think that lasted probably 6 months. And from there, I met Jeremy Vaney at an X conference near D.C., one of Stephen Bassett's disclosure things, which we always went to for a laugh. And and Jeremy and I met there. And he was doing, you know, and he's going to kill me because I honestly don't remember what the name of his podcast was. But it was much more successful and listened to than my own. And he and I were on the phone one night and he said, you know, I'm sick of doing my podcast. And I said, you know, we should do one together. And within a week, we had a name, Paratopia. And Paratopia then went on to run for, I don't know, over 4 years and 170-some episodes that were all about 3 hours long or more, plus a live show on the weekends. And we discontinued that after we just felt it kind of ran its course. It was a premium podcast for the most part. And because every server that we got put on, they'd kick us off because we had too many people like accessing the server and crashing servers on Friday nights. Like, I'm not kidding. It was ridiculous. And so we stopped and we kind of did our own thing for a while. Jeremy now hosts The Experience on Whitley Strieber's unknowncountry.com. And I pretty much stick to doing our podcast. Jeremy and I started up Paratopia Oculus. About 10 episodes ago now. And it's probably the most unstructured, you know, kind of just wild ride of a podcast that you could possibly want to listen to on these subjects. I mean, we just kind of like we start off on a topic and it goes where it goes. Normally, we don't have guests. It's pretty much just he and I, just because we feel more work gets done that way. you know, and we talk about we don't talk about predominantly what's going on in the quote unquote field. Like that doesn't happen. So if you're looking for like your favorite writers or your favorite, you know, niche researchers, you won't find them on there. We kind of go more towards experimental thinking, thought projects of, you know, how can we engage this phenomenon in some kind of meaningful way that we can maybe garner some kind of information that, that may not be available through, you know, the typical researchers. Like we're looking for other stuff, the deeper aspects of it.
Right.
So that's what we're doing now. And that's at paratopiaoculus.com.
Cool. All right. And you do have a project we're going to be talking about in a little bit. That's really fascinating. But I want you to get into some of your experiences. Like what got you interested in this stuff in the first place?
Wow. Wow. It's so much. It's like, you know, you ever listen to these podcast people or you know, your audience? You know, I'm talking to them now. You guys ever listen to these podcasts or radio shows where some guy rambles on for like an hour and you go, what a mental case this guy is? Well, that's usually because there's so much that you just like, how do you frame this? So, if I ramble, just put the brakes on me.
Sure.
I'll try to hit like the important bits that kind of woke me up a little bit. I would say from the age of 5 and possibly earlier, I had some pretty weird experiences at night. These experiences are probably the most potent memories of my life. And always have been there. And I can picture them in my mind like I've done a million times. And they have not changed. They are what they are. I mean, like every kid, you know, mom would tuck me in. I lived in suburban Baltimore County. Had great parents, great friends, great neighborhood. You know, I mean, it was like, it was literally the perfect suburbia life. And, I would go to bed at night. Mom would tuck me in and she would go back out to watch TV with my dad for a couple of hours. Would leave a bathroom nightlight on for me. And, to give people an idea, the lay of the room, most of the time, my bed was against a wall and to my right was the bedroom door, which led out to a hallway. To the left was my mom and dad's room. To the right was the bathroom, like immediate right. And to my left, when I'm laying in bed, was a window that looked out onto a street lamp and the street and the mailbox and the rest of the yard. And so, like any kid, I didn't go to bed when I was told, and no kid does. And now that I got a 20-something-year-old that I've raised, I know this to be true. And I would sit up and play or, you know, kind of try and read a book by the low light that was in the room. And the best way I can describe this is just to describe my perception of what happened. At one particular time, I was kind of playing with some little army guys on the edge of the bed, trying to be quiet so mom didn't hear me. And I began to see a white dot in a, like little dead in the center of my field of vision. And it looked to be, I don't want to say pulsating, but it had like a vibratory quality to it. It looked like it was slightly blurred. And it began to get larger in my field of vision. And no matter where I looked, it was always dead in the center of my field of vision. And I shut my eyes, it was still there. Open my eyes, it was still there. Look in the light, it was still there. Look towards darkness, it was even more there. And so I panicked a little bit, but you're more or less overwhelmed with this. As a kid, I remember thinking to myself, what is this? What's going on? Well, it can't be anything to worry about because no one's ever told me about this. And before I knew it, it had literally filled my field of view. And it was a spinning square that was spinning, perfect square, white, for you graphic design people out there, like a perfect vector square, no fuzzy edges, rotating as if it's on a pinwheel in the center and getting larger and larger until, I don't know how else to put it other than say, I white it out. And I have no idea how much time passes, but I would more or less come out of this sometime later because I could hear my father snoring in the next room. So I knew they were then in bed. All the lights in the house were out except for that nightlight in the bedroom or in the bathroom. And this is where the whole story kind of gets exceedingly weird, as this is apt to do. When I would wake up, here's typical, I couldn't move. So there's your stereotype paralysis thing. But I could move my neck and head. And at times I could move my feet. And at times I could move my arms. There were variables in this. This happened, and this is where everybody goes, really? Well, really, this happened every night. Every night. Wow. I would wake up, not be... At some points, the window to my left and the doorway to my right were there. At times, it was not. I don't know what that means, whether if I was not in the room or whether I was in the room. Maybe, I don't know. But whatever sheets were on the bed that I was in were gone. What was covering me was a single black sheet, black pillowcase, black slip cover on the bed, hospital tight corners, hospital, stretched across me so tight that you're practically getting your circulation cut off. And this blue light shone down on the bed, me and the whole thing. And you could sometimes see outside of this blue light, but most of the time it was so intense. I remember many occasions looking and seeing dust particles falling in the air. And at times, and there were variables in this, I would, and of course I would be absolutely horrified. I mean, terror is not a good enough word. I think there's a really good word to describe it. Just sheer panic. You can't get enough air in your lungs to scream. I did try. I could get out some sound, but no one ever seemed to respond to it. For lack of a better way to put it, either I would pass out from just sheer horror because I'd wake up the next morning and everything would be fine.
Right.
But at times I would wake up in that blue light with the black sheets and the whole scenario of the white square and everything like that all went like textbook every night. But sometimes there were variables, like at times I would see small, big-headed people around the edge of the bed. You couldn't make out features. All you could see would be like the tops of the head. At least that's what I perceived them as, heads. And they would whisper to each other. Like, you couldn't understand what they were saying. It was kind of like this strange type of almost chanting sound to it. But at times it was, that kind of thing, back and forth. And I would lay there and listen to them and try and make out facial features, and you just couldn't. And at one time, I was told by my mom, I told her the whole story one night. I said, this is what happens. Does this happen to you? Is this normal? What are those people that come in the night? Like, who are these people? Cause I can't move. And she said, well, you're dreaming. That's what this is. It's a dream. And so I said, no, Mom, this is not a dream. And I remember saying to myself, tonight when this happens, I'm going to sit up and I'm going to prove to her that this is not a dream. I'm going to prove it to myself. And that night I did indeed sit up in the blue light with the black sheets. And I pulled these sheets literally up to my face. And I said, these sheets are black. I am not dreaming. I am awake. What is going on here? And again, I heard some whispering here and there. There was no bedroom door. There was no bedroom window. And to my left, I saw a pair of hands start coming into the light towards me. They were extraordinarily long fingers with black fingernails, rather long black fingernails. Not in a threatening way. They weren't, you know, oogity boogity coming at me. It was just kind of like reaching in to touch my leg or to touch at me or to, you know, you almost got a sense that, you know, is this somebody trying to comfort me in some way? Right. And to that, I have no memory after that. I don't remember how it ends. I don't remember how any of these experiences end for those times. And there were so many other variables, like, you know, playing with someone in the doorway of my bedroom very late at night. It was cold. I remember it was chilly in the house. And this is often what happens at, you know, 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning. And I'm playing with someone by my door and they don't look like me, but I can't really look at them. Like I talk to them, but I don't really look at them. And then they say something like, you want to take a piggyback ride? And I said, sure. And I got on their shoulders, not looking at them. I just kind of was put on their shoulders and we glided down the hallway. And I thought, well, this is weird. Nobody's walking. We're actually gliding. It was like being pulled on a pulley. And we went out towards the kitchen and the dog growled and we politely turned like, you know, like literally just made a loop like, nope, that's not going to work. Let's go out the front door. The front door opened without anybody opening it. And we went outside. To that, I don't remember anything else. You know, and these things happen intermittently. There was only one time for that, but there were these strange, weird, non-UFO, quote-unquote, connected events that I really, all my life, I never knew what to do with them. But I knew that they were incredibly powerful experiences that I'd had, and I didn't know what to do with it. Yeah. And they happen every day, or every night, rather. I say every night. There may have been a couple nights where it didn't happen, but right. By and large, every night from the ages of 5 to 9.
Did they just stop at that point?
On my 9th birthday, we had a birthday party, and as usual, all the guests went home, and you know, and as parents do, you know. They put me to bed and I had some toys that I had gotten for my birthday. I was playing with them and I wasn't going to sleep. Not on a bed. I was full of cake and, you know, pixie sticks. I'm not going to sleep. Right. So it's 9:30 and I'm like, okay, it's time for bed, but whatever. You know, I'm playing and mom and dad, I can hear them talking about, you know, did you see what so-and-so's kid did to the house and this and the other? And I distinctly remember them going into the bedroom because I remember I got to play like I'm asleep. So I drop down and I play, you know, I play like I'm asleep. And they're in their room and I hear them talking and giggling. And meanwhile, I'm playing and I'm giddy that they don't know I'm awake and that I'm listening to them talk. And And so I'm laying there, I was sitting up at that time, and there's this enormous flash from outside the window. And I don't know, I guess the best description that I've heard somebody talk about, most notably Colin Andrews had mentioned this at one time to me, that there was a point where it feels like all the air out of the room is sucked out. And that's a really good description. That's kind of what it felt like, because there was the sound of, you know, an air conditioner, and there was the sound of my dog's nails on the linoleum in the kitchen, and there was the sound of mom and dad talking real low and hushed whispers, you know. And all of a sudden, when that flash went off, it all just stopped. And it was this weird kind of silence that was just pin drop quiet.
Well, it's the Oz factor.
Yeah. 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 And I didn't, I mean, I didn't, I don't know what I equated that to, but I was like, okay, that's weird. I don't hear them. And I called out. I said, Mom, Dad, nobody answered. Very strange. And then I heard somebody walking down the hallway. And for those kids who, like me, who grew up in the 70s and 80s, you remember shag carpet, right? That stuff makes a racket when you walk on it. And I could hear this shuffling in the hallway. And into my room walks this man. Probably, I don't know, 4.5 feet tall or so. Skin like silly putty. Not porous skin, not textured skin, but really smooth looking, slightly dirty looking, quite large eyes. I don't know how correct the communion alien is, but it's close to that. Like there's something not quite right about that. The shape of the head isn't quite right, and the eyes certainly aren't perfect, but that's as close as I think we're going to be able to get in this kind of weird experience thing to try and equate a look to. It was kind of that look, only there was this variable. It had a hat on that that looked like spun copper. It was kind of shaped, and I always said when I was little, I said it's shaped like a rice paddy hat, because I'd always see these people on MASH in the rice paddies with these hats on. Well, it looked like that, except they were, it was a little more rounded than that. And it was copper colored, bronzes colored, and it looked like a wok lid. And he came over to me, and I thought, I wasn't scared. I don't know why I wasn't scared. I should have been, but I wasn't. I said, what a neat thing this is. This must be some surprise that Mom and Dad have set up. What's this about? This guy's funny looking. Okay. And I leaned over towards him off the bed, like I'm leaning, and he's standing beside the bed looking at me. And I leaned over to him. And I said, who are you? And he put his hand up, like, don't talk. And then he rubbed his hands together real flat. And I noticed when he put his hands together, abnormally long fingers with black fingernails. And I'm like, okay. And he rubbed his fingers together and he turned his palms toward me, both hands, like nothing here, nothing here. Showed me the back of his hands, front of his hands. He pulled his hands apart as if he was going to clap. And I thought, well, this is where it's all exposed. This is where I find out what this is all about. You know, this is the surprise. And he claps his hands. And when he claps his hands, it's, again, here's the bizarre part, if this all wasn't bizarre enough. It's like a gong going off. It's like the biggest gong, like a gong the size of the neighborhood. Gets cracked right next to your ear, you know, with a big mallet. And it's this, it just is, it blew right through me. All of a sudden, this enormous wave of fear swept over me. I fell backwards, and I remember nothing else. And I had these memories, like, my whole life. And never knew, what is that? Like, what was that? And I would tell people intermittently in my life about that. Like, I would say to the guidance counselor at school, well, you know those people that come in your room with the blue light at night? Like, and she would go, I'm sorry, what? And I'd go, no, nothing. Never mind. Like, occasionally it would get me the weird looks. But a lot of people that I would talk to would go, well, that's pretty fascinating. Like, what do you think that was? I said, I have no idea what it was. You know, throughout my young days of 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, probably stopped around 15, 16, somewhere in there. But, you know, I had UFO sightings, daylight, predominantly daylight. One particular one I remember was very odd in that it was a red ball, shiny. Seemed to be structured, you know, with a seam in the middle. Was seriously spinning. And I guess the best way to put it is that it would flash, like there was a big flash where it was. Very spiky flash, like a cartoon type, like Wile E. Coyote getting hit with a mallet, right? That kind of spiky flash, and it would just be gone. It would just disappear. And then it would flash again, and it would be there again. And it would do this over and over for 5 minutes. And finally, it winked out, and it didn't come back. And so I ran into my mom, and I said, "Mom, you're never going to believe what I just saw." And I explained it to her, and she looked at me like I've never seen her look since. Blank. She looked very blank at me. And she said, "Maybe it was a weather balloon." And I just went outside, and I said, I remember standing on the breezeway and saying, "What's a weather balloon?" And I wouldn't get the joke, of course, until years later. And and so, you know, when I started hearing about people having very bizarre experiences with hauntings and with UFOs, and I said, that was what this is. And then, when I saw the cover of Communion and saw some artwork from other places that really resembled what I remember seeing in my room that night, I said, "This is what this is. This is a UFO thing, and this stuff is a definitive ghost thing," because I also had those kind of experiences with this stuff too. And and sometimes the two would intermingle, and in some, you know, kind of bizarre duet. But I think the most bizarre things are what are the most important bits of this. And as you and I were talking before the program, like, I really don't subscribe to the, like, I don't know what this is. Like, I don't know. I think a lot of what people have been told about paranormal phenomena is not the whole story. And so there is a level of bizarreness and a level of self-negation to this experience that renders it fodder for skeptics and for people to make fun of. So I understand all why it's made fun of and why it's marginalized and all that. Makes it no less irritating, but I get it. I totally get it. But I had, well, I had plenty of other things throughout my life that kind of led up to a big experience that kind of like said, "Yep, that's what it is." And that involved my wife, you know. And
well, before we get to that, let me ask you this. When you saw the white square, mm-hmm. was it like just a color or of white, or was it actually look like light?
No, it literally looked like when I do presentations, which are damn rare. I have a flash video that I show, and it's literally a vector white square that is rotating on a pin axis in the center. You know, there was no pin axis in the center of this thing. It was just a white square rotating as if on a pinwheel. It wasn't a light per se. It was just, this visual perception of this growing geometric shape. And I don't know what to make of that. The one thing that I found out from psychologists and psychoanalysts and even neurologists over the years is that the mind works in geometry. Visionary things work in geometry. And so I'm thinking to myself, well, if this is, as I know it to be now, is some, I guess we can call it other intelligence or an other of some kind. There's somebody else in the apartment building is what I'm getting at here, folks. I don't know what it is, but there's definitely somebody else in the building. Then that would be an effective way of trying, I guess, to communicate is in baseline geometry, that would be kind of a communication of sorts. Now, what it said, I have no idea.
Maybe you were occasionally waking up from the Matrix into the real world.
I mean, you know, I'll tell you what, you know, honest to God, what I thought at the moment that some of these things were happening, when I would see that white square, I would get, I don't know where these thoughts came from a 5, 6, 7-year-old kid. But I would say things to myself like, it's okay, they're just coming to finish me. I'm not done yet. whatever that means. I will say that, I've been a working commercial designer and artist for all my professional career. Like, literally, that's all I wanted to do my entire life. And that, literally, that creative, offshoot started in those times, during those periods where I was having these experiences. This is where, like, a wellspring of creative stuff welled up from me. And from there, it was, not just like, oh, he can draw really well. It was like, no, we need to get this kid into a G&T program, and he needs to go away for summers to like art colonies and stuff like that. And, right. And it was really weird. I mean, it was weird taking art classes next to people who are like in their teens and 20s and like, you know.
And also, for anyone who doesn't know, G&T is gifted and talented.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of stuff.
Do they even still have those anymore?
I don't know, honestly. I don't know. My last one that I went to was when I was in 11th grade, between 11th and 12th grade. They sent me to Goucher College to do that. You know, it was like a two-week really intensive period of painting and drawing and visualization to, you know, like not having to look at an object to draw it, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was a lot of fun. I mean, I really enjoyed that thing. And I've always enjoyed what I do. But I always wonder, you know, like, where'd that come from? Like, is that what I meant when I said that? Like, I don't know. I didn't even know that that was necessarily my thought. That's the creepy part about it. Mm. Like, people often, you'll hear people talk in this field about, well, I heard a voice in my head from this alien being that spoke to me, and he spoke to me through telepathy. And, you know, people say that, and that's fine if you want to believe that, but your audience members need to close their eyes for a second and then imagine something in front of them that isn't human. And now imagine hearing a voice in your head that isn't you. That's scary, man. That's nothing trite and common. There's nothing common about that. And I've had that, and it's excruciatingly bizarre. It's fearful beyond comprehension. I mean, did I think I was going crazy? Absolutely. At one point in my life, absolutely. Absolutely. You know,
when you were having this every night, did it ever like null the fear for you after a while?
No, it really didn't.
What do you think the fear was mainly caused by? Was it just like an animalistic type of fear, or was it something you were actually afraid of?
I think it was the idea that I didn't know what was going on, and I think, like most human beings, I don't like loss of control. And I think being paralyzed or not being able to move like I normally would move, and it wasn't always complete paralysis. Sometimes it was just like, yeah, I can't really leave this bed. Because I don't know what's outside of that light. Like, is my bed floating? I don't know. Right. I can't see the floor. So I don't know what's going on outside. And I felt like at least I can see in here. That's something people ask me a lot, because I've had a lot more hair-raising stuff than that. And, you know, and that by comparison to later stuff in life was tame.
But not for a kid.
No, not for a kid. What is still kind of confounding to me is how, later on in life, and I probably never said this on any other time I've ever, it just literally just occurred to me, is like the innocence factor in all of that when you're a kid. Like, you are such an open little eggshell, you know? It's like you're like a sponge, you soak up everything.
Yeah.
And when you get older, you've always got these preconceived ideologies that then color everything that happens and every event mm-hmm. that you have in your life. And I think at that point, when you're that little, you're dealing with things like, you know, dealing with other kids and the start of bullies and all that kind of stuff. You've got all that to deal with. And then you've got these things at night that won't let you sleep, you know, and then you've got stuff like, you know, well, Jeff doesn't stay awake in class, you know. That could be because, you know,
so it was actually affecting your sleep.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To the point where mom took me to the doctor a couple times because, you know, she said he looks so tired all the time. He's got these circles under his eyes. He shouldn't have these circles under his eyes. He's young, you know? And he's like, are you sleeping well, kiddo? And I'm like, not really, you know. And I didn't really tell. I never have told a doctor, per se, about the things I'd experienced until much later on. Right. But as a kid, I didn't bring that up because I saw the faces of people that I did talk about it to. And I was like, nah, I got enough to deal with like, you know, with, well, in some years later with like braces and girls and all that stuff. Right. Like you got all sure. that to deal with. Who wants to deal with this? So
now, did you see any UFOs while this stuff was happening? Like initially?
No.
So that only started after the last event.
Yes.
Huh?
Yeah. I mean,
it's almost like it transitioned into something else.
Well, I can't say that the UFO I described, the daylight one, I can't really say that was after. That was pretty much like right smack in the middle, like probably 6 or 7 years old. But that was kind of a one-off. It wasn't until later on, after 9 years old, that I began to get these glimpses of things in the sky. And and some of them were lengthy. And I should say that I grew up really close to Loch Raven Dam. And if anybody out there in Google land wants to Google Loch Raven Dam UFO, you'll see that that's been there's been some interesting cases in there. And I would say that the red ball that I described earlier, that was towards that direction that I was looking. So, again, I can't make the solid confirmation. I have no photograph. I have only my memory of that. But the interesting bit about that sighting in particular was that somebody was with me, and I can't remember who they were. I remember saying, don't you see this? Don't you see what this? They're like, yeah, come on, let's just go play. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not playing right now. Yeah, I'm looking at this. You don't see
like this. Like it wasn't bothering.
Like it didn't bother them at all. Like it had no, you know, like they didn't care. Like, yeah, I see it. So what? Let's play. And that's disturbing.
Well, yes and no, because you figure a kid may just figure it's something they just didn't know about.
Could possibly be, you know. And I really only had one kid in the neighborhood that I played with, and he passed away from esophageal cancer a few years ago, and I remember asking him before he got sick, and we were talking one night. I said, do you remember that? Do you have any memory of that at all? He says, dude, it must have been somebody else. It wasn't me. He said, we weren't even hanging out then. I didn't know you at that age. I knew you like around 9 or 10 years old. I said, dude, I can't remember who that was. And that bothers me to this day, that I can picture somebody standing beside the tree in the front lawn, and I cannot picture their face. Yeah. I don't know who that was. But the fact that they wanted me to go with them and ignore this thing, like that's bothersome to me now, knowing, you know, how a phenomena kind of just kind of how, you know, folklore has worked over the years on this subject and the tangents that are reached in that kind of place. So it's bothersome. But no, the fear of this stuff is never, I'm still afraid of it. I still have abnormal fear about it.
Why do you think that is?
Because it's inherently fearful. and that's something that I've worked on, I've tried to work on over the years. And I would say that as a man who's going to be 50 years old next year, I would say I'm more curious these days, but I still have a healthy respect for its distance.
Mm.
It's the best way I can know to put it. Like, I don't want it in my house, but it's in my house. You know, it's been in every place that I've lived. And so I don't expect it's going to wane anytime soon unless I completely disengage from the entire field and the whole subject and all of that. I mean, that can happen, but, you know, it's a healthy respect for it these days, but I'm more curious about the mechanism of it.
Yeah.
You know, why is not a productive question to ask, but you know, why?
I've with my experiences, it almost seemed to me like they were trying to teach me to overcome fear.
And that is one way to look at it. Yeah.
Yeah, because after a while, I learned how to disconnect. Like, yeah, okay, this is really scary. I'm just going to put that off to the side and just deal with that on a very logical level.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a, I mean, there's a point for me that that I almost realized that this, I guess, in no small part came from just interacting with people who were other experiencers who I trusted and who had things happen to them that were somewhat similar to me. Not so much in like the visuals or any of the, or the scenarios, but more along the lines of just the ultra, ultra weird, the disconnect from sensible discussion, I guess is the best way to put it. Like, it really is hard to talk about these things because there are words that just don't quite fit, but nonetheless are the only thing you've got. And yeah. I saw this same inner fight with other experiencers. And when we would talk about this stuff, we would go into these places where you don't hear these things talked about on radio or podcast or even written in books for that matter. And what I kind of got was it's that, I think the way that you approach this or the way that you initially react to it is then its blueprint for further manifestations of what comes at you. So in other words, if I was inherently fearful of what I saw, even though these experiences weren't, you know, always oogity boogity scary, then that would, it was, it's almost like, and I'm not saying this is how it works, but it's almost like this thing doesn't know how to relate to us. And so when we go, we scream and we go, oh my God, what is this? And your heart's pounding and you're palpitating and, you know, you're sweating and freaking out. It goes, oh, that's okay. Boogity boogity. Like, it doesn't get it. Like, it goes, okay, that's, I can be scary if that's what you want. Okay, that's clearly what you want because that's how you're reacting to me. Maybe it's that, I'm like, that's like the scenario I play around with in my head. I know that's not how this works. I get that that's not what this is really saying, but it's almost like, it's almost like it's childlike in that kind of way. If you look at, if you frame the discussion in that kind of context, you could say, well, maybe it doesn't know how to react to you. And so it's giving you, it's a mirror. It's reflecting at you what you're putting out.
Yes.
And so that does some have some validity to me, but it's so much more complex than that idea.
The way I've been looking at it is, I mean, first of all, I don't think we understand what reality is.
Well, I
think we understand it in the slightest bit. And I think we need a completely new map of it to really even include this stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think there, when these things interject into our reality, I don't think our brain has anything to put on it.
Correct.
You know, it's almost like, okay, there's this weird energy signature that I'm getting and I don't know what to do with it. Let's put a monster there because it's weird and I don't know what it is and we don't know what monsters are. So monster.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And then that thing has to interact with us from that state of monster because that's what we gave it.
That's what you skin it with. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that. I mean, to me, there is this kind of, I don't know, there's definitely a cultural filter. When you look at this across, like, Americans, it's one thing for the most part, or a couple of different variations. But when you get into, like, South America or even overseas, you get these different manifestations of this kind of thing, which I find to be really interesting. So there's a cultural aspect to this. There's also a psychological aspect to this. Like, that's the big thing in UFO land. And this is the really disappointing thing to me about mainstream ufology is like it's you know, like like a psychologist is the antichrist in that field, you know, like there's always this really hardcore effort to refute the psychological and you know, like that to me is an extremely short-sighted view to take. Like there is a psychological component to this, no question about it. Is it all psychological? Well, all of reality is psychological, if you want. You all live within the confines of the 3-pound brain in your skull. So that's your 3-pound reality. You know, so there's that. But let's go past that and say, okay, it's well-known established medical fact that the brain is a dampening mechanism. Okay. It confines us to, you know, a certain visual spectrum, taste, touch, smell, hearing, these things. I think it's well established now in science that this reality that we recognize with our visual cortex and all of our other senses is not even close to everything that there is.
Oh, sure.
And so it feels like to me, like for a brief instant in a paranormal event, that that dampening mechanism is like chains off. You get it all for about, you know, a minute or two or maybe less. Some people longer, some people it drives to the brink of insanity. I've seen this. Yes, this does drive people as batty as you accuse people of being. Mm-hmm. So yes. But if the brain is a dampening mechanism, what is the brain doing in an experience like this? We don't know because there's never been any funding to try and test this kind of thing. And this kind of gets into the, you know, the marginal viewpoint that the world takes on paranormal studies in general. Parapsychology in general really is a marginal field. So, but yeah, I mean, for me, this has been at times textbook as far as the UFO portions of it go, but has some very weird components that... that involve people around me as well. Like, it's not just relegated to me.
Right.
At a certain point, like I said, my wife and I had a pinnacle experience that kind of opened the floodgates and our lives became the proverbial three-ring circus for a few years. And that
before
was really
we
hard.
Before we get into that, sure. Though, let's talk about the project you have ongoing right now. Now you did another thing called Project Core.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what was the goal of Project Core?
Now, the Project Core was with Jeremy Vaney and I kind of talked three research scientists into joining us. So we had a certain academic approach to this thing into data gathering from people who had paranormal experiences. We absolutely didn't put any chains on or any restrictions on what they felt, their experience felt. And like, it wasn't just UFO abductions, quote unquote abductions. I hate that word, but that experience or ghost or djinn or what, take your pick. It could be anything in the paranormal field or realm. And we got them to fill out, a multiple choice questionnaire, very short, maybe 20 questions, and then a large blank field on the webpage where they could basically say, here it is, guys, tell us what your experience was. If it's more than one, pick your most, you know, extreme one. Pick the one that had the most influence on you and tell us what happened. They had a lot of room to write. In fact, I don't think there was any limit on characters in that. And so other questions were, what's your blood type? Do you know what it is? Here, tell us what your blood type is. Have you ever taken an IQ test? Yes or no? If you did, how did you score? And IQ tests are, again, they're very
arbitrary.
Yeah. I mean, that's the best way to put it. You can't really say what's a good and what's a bad IQ test. There's some that you can definitely say are bad, but you don't, what constitutes a good one? We don't know. Things like, what is your national heritage? You know, what nationality are you? And where does your ancestral heritage come from? Things like, have you ever messed with psychedelic drugs? Have you ever had a relationship with an occult practice, Wicca, to a Ouija board, any of that?
I'm pretty sure I filled this out. How many years ago was this that you did this?
Several now at this point. I'm pretty sure you probably did at some point or another. Because a lot of people did. I mean, we got over like around 250 responses. We rejected some of them because one of the context problems or the contextual problems with this particular thing was, if your thing was UFO related, we did not accept testimony that was retrieved under hypnotic regression, because everybody at the table really said, and I've long fought against that practice for decades now, and it's a useless tool for retrieving nothing. I mean, it's useless.
Yeah.
So we don't want that. And a couple of people gave us that anyway, and we just rejected those. And you know, we got it done, and then it was reading all of these accounts, you know, over 200. And it was like some of this stuff was truly off the charts bizarre. And
right.
You read this stuff and you go, it's too dumb to make up, you know, like in your wildest dreams. No. And so, you know, there's this ring of, yes, this is ring of familiarity to what you've experienced. And so, and some things you would read and go, I can't conceive of this, but if this is what this person reports, you know, I'm reading it. And so we were very open about that. But then it was to amalgamate all of the data that we collected. And being an anonymous survey, you know, we got interesting results, but it was a preliminary first step. And what we saw was essentially the people that report paranormal phenomena who responded to this survey, yes, were a lot of Irish, Celtic, German descent, as far as ancestral heritage. Also, a lot of Native American ancestral heritage responded. A lot of people with above average IQ, at least. You know, some blood type similarities were reported in there. I'm getting ready to put this study back up. The whole totality of it, the commentaries from three of the people who participated in it, me, Jeremy, and one of the research scientists, Dr. Ellen Tarr, you know, we all wrote kind of a piece on it, like what we got from it, even though it was a preliminary first step. Like, here's where we should go with this. And as I mentioned to you, it's being moved because nobody really cared. Because, and this is something that I negated to mention in our prior discussion, you know, it was not widely read. I think the more serious components of ufology and the paranormal did read it. Our George Hansen, a good friend of mine, who is a groundbreaker in this field to me.
Absolutely.
He read it. He was very impressed, and I think he was quite skeptical about us being able to do anything of substance to start with, and he was very pleasantly surprised. He thought it was great. A great first step. And again, being a first step, you don't reach conclusions at a first step. So
right.
Taking an academic approach to this thing, having a real statistician on board to actually do the work, and to have, you know, like understudies for this from these professors that were working with us on the, we had really nice stuff, really organized well, thoughtfully presented, and the paranormal world said, yeah, we don't care. Because you don't say ghosts and you don't say flying saucers aliens. And aliens and extraterrestrials or whatever. So so there was that.
Do you realize that when you said the German English heritage, you said high IQ, these are some of the same things that David Politis is finding among missing people.
Hmm. Yes. And I don't know what to say about that right now.
Yeah, it's just, but it is. It's there. That's the same pattern he's finding, or the same patterns you're finding in these experiencers.
Yes. I mean, nobody wants to walk through the purple door and never be seen again. But does it happen? I don't know. I'm not at that juncture yet. If you know, I don't want it to be me. I'll put it to you that way. you know, but. But yes, there are these similar things that are very interesting, but need further study to substantiate these into something meaningful.
Sure.
And we need a much broader survey net. You know, when we set an online survey, we expected quite a turnout. And the facts of the matter are, you can't get a significant turnout in this field from people when you're asking for a lot of people to put forth. I tried to make it so that it was the most minimal effort.
Right.
To fill this out. Very simple. Another guy out there it had a survey, and it was like some ridiculous number of questions, and it required, you know, probably more than an hour to fill out. That's retarded. Wow. That's just ridiculous. You're not going to get massive returns on something like that. You've got to keep it simple. You've got to keep it concise. But the next step is decidedly more invasive, to where we have to try to establish an IQ test. We have to try and establish blood testing for all participants. And then, you know, try to substantiate these things in a meaningful way so that it's statistically viable. That's what you have to do. And I know that's all really dry and boring stuff and nobody cares. But, you know, somewhere along the line, something pops out at you about this stuff. And that goes to the project now, which is Project Oculus. So what I took away from this was pretty much what George Hansen laid in my lap or showed to me. You know, for years I had seen, long before I met George, I had seen these patterns in people that they were often artistically inclined. They were creative types. They were really articulate and smart. But they lived these like non-routine lifestyles and, didn't fall into the mold of routine like a lot of people do. And I always wondered what that was. Like, it's really weird because they're a lot like, Bill's a lot like John and Katie's a lot like Jane. And why are these people so similar? And, and George basically said, these are people living an anti-structural lifestyle. They're in liminal states, which means between things, states of change, edge of chaos, that sort of thing. And this goes into the marginal personalities, which are often found in this field, marginal people, people who are easily dismissed. So people that are into routine or into structure would look upon the anti-structural people as losers, cranks, kooks, nutbags, you know, this type. So this is why this thing is marginalized. This is why this is. And so I go, okay, so if the paranormal does manifest more along the lines of out of routine situations, people, places, events, great. So I've had this in my life, most of my life, because I live that way. I do art. I'm very, like, if I get an inspiration to do something at 2 o'clock in the morning, I do it. And damn going to sleep the next day. I mean, that's just it. And so what happens when you immerse yourself in that kind of life? What happens if you take hold of that and live that? And try not to think about, I'm living this anti-structure, just be it. And so that's the Project Oculus, which is up right now at GoFundMe.com/Project Oculus. If you go there and you search for paranormal, I should come up pretty high on the list. And the idea here is that we're going to try to engage phenomena that I've seen and photographed around my house. And there's a couple of examples in the video on that page of light phenomena in the hallway that is really weird and bright and super colorful for a cell phone photograph, but doesn't reflect light. In other words, there's no indirect lighting. It's strictly, the light is coagulated around the object, whatever that object of intense light is. I sent those photographs when I took them to Ted Phillips of the Landing Trace case group. And, he's been studying this Marley Woods case for years now. And he said, in fact, this is what they see in Marley Woods. This is that same bright, rich colored, oversaturated color with light, bright light, that doesn't seem to reflect on the ground, the trees, the environment. It's non-reflective light, which doesn't make a lot of sense in our neat little reality here. And so my thought is, well, if we integrate live cams into the environment of my home and we completely ensconce them, in other words, they become part of the house. It's not like, well, cameras are watching. No, we just put cameras up and we live with them. And we live this, I live an anti-structural lifestyle anyway. So depending on what I do, if I have an intense art project that I'm working on, if I'm working on some deadline for work, I'm staying up late, I'm eating odd hours, I'm not eating right, I'm, you know, gaining and losing weight. But there's also this added element of we're renovating our house.
Mm.
And the example I use in the video on the GoFundMe page is we've all heard the story of, you know, the couple who buys their fixer-upper dream home. And the minute they start renovating, the ghosts in the house don't like them renovating, and so they haunt them. And I just ask people to look at it a different way in that they are not disrupting the ghosts in the house. They are in a state of change. They have bought this house, so they're out of routine. They're not used to the new house. They're also renovating. They're changing the house from what it was to what it will be. That's a state of betwixt, between, liminal state, right? Textbook. Is it any wonder why they start having paranormal experiences of ghosts in the house when this happens? This fits perfectly within the textbook of liminal states, anti-structural behavior. It's not just the house. It's the people. The people are living like out of cardboard boxes a lot of times when they first move in or when they're renovating. They're not sleeping the same. They may not be going to work regular hours. You know, and there may be stress and friction in the house. All of this stuff combined. This is what, here's my favorite catchphrase, this is what surrounds paranormal events. This is what people don't look at. All we want to look at is, what was the ghost wearing? Or what kind of alien abducted you? We need to start thinking about, what was your life like at the time? What surrounded this event? What was life like for you at this point? And people hear that and immediately go, well, he's just trying to reduce it to the psychological. Not at all. This is about life. This is about, how does this ensconce itself in our life to be there in that moment? What was it surrounded by? And what you find time after time after time. Anti-structural behavior, marginal places, people, things. It's all over it. It's all over it. And so my thought is, if I can make it all over me, it's going to be all over this house. And so a camera outside, which we've seen some strange things in our lawn. inside, in the hallway, near the bathroom. Pretty hot area for weird stuff in this house. Maybe some nights we throw the camera in the living room. I want to change it up. I don't want it to be a routine place where the camera is, because routine is not conducive to this.
Right.
Change is. And so what I'm trying to get funding for is to buy drop cams, which are moderately expensive, but not horrible, but they're super dependable. They have great night vision. They have great audio. They can be recorded online. Nest, the parent company, for a fee every month, will record you, will DVR all of your feeds in 1080p, right? So it seems like the best of all worlds. Now, the better part that we can do to add to this, and the reason that funding is so important, is that, yeah, three cameras is around $600-$800 or a little more. By the time you figure in the Nest fee, I don't know what that's going to be to record these things. But any way you cut it, it's a lot of money. I also want to add some things in, like how about a tri-field meter running, a natural tri-field meter. So we have natural EMF being monitored in the room. If we get something on camera in the room and it's recorded, and it's detected by the camera, which is the great part about these cameras, is they have movement detection. So you can put a hot area over the whole screen. If something moves in that room, that camera's going to message you. It's going to record that, monitor it, and it's going to say, on your timeline, here's a little yellow bit where I saw something happen. Very easy to twaddle through these things and monitor it. So it's the best of all worlds, but if we get something on camera, wouldn't it be great to have the tri-field meter respond in kind to the image on the screen?
Yeah.
It's not enough just to have the visuals. Take it from a visual analyst for the past 30 years. It's not enough. You need something else. You need correlation of a couple of different things. So equipment, I've got one thing that's been kind of okie-doed by the parapsychological community that I've interacted with, they seem to like this piece of equipment. We're going to utilize that. But there's still other things we want to get. So, you know, for $20, a $20 donation, which I don't think is terrible, I give you a password or an access to, you know, where we're going to have the live feeds going on a web page. And you'll be able to look at those and monitor them yourself.
Nice.
And so that's kind of like, that's my only perk. I don't have a lot to offer, folks. It's just watch my house. But, you know, Hess Dahlin, the Hess Dahlin project has been pretty successful with this kind of thing. Catching, you know, anomalous lights and activity around Hess Dahlin. And, you know, I'm doing kind of the same thing, but I'm trying to directly engage this by living an anti-structural life, by changing my house. Renovations are going on. Things are in flux. It's the perfect time. So, and the good news is that there's no end to this. It's like, if they don't work in one spot, we move them. We try something else. It's an ongoing experiment, which I don't think really has been done before. So I could use everybody's help with it, because I unfortunately can't do it alone.
And the question beyond all this is, why do liminal areas bring this stuff in? Why does anti-structural behavior draw this stuff in?
I can only parrot George Hansen and say that why is not a productive question to ask. I don't know. There's so much I don't know. I mean,
I think going into my interview with George Hansen, I thought that it was that, you know, we're changing our behavior, so we're noticing things we may not notice otherwise. But he corrected me and said that's not necessarily the case.
No, I mean, it may be a part of it. You know, but I think we got to be really careful not to exclude the psychological from it. In other words, some of these behaviors are psychologically rooted. I mean, my psychology is that, and I'm not kidding, this is how my work, my job, my home artwork that I do. If I'm asleep on the couch and I wake up and I go to the kitchen and pour a glass of milk and I go, oh man, that's an awesome idea. I'm out in the shop like 10 minutes later, like drawing it up and going, all right, I got to get to bed, but I'm on to this in the morning. And sometimes you wake up in the morning and you go, this is crap. Or sometimes you go, I got to build this like right now. And that's just how it works for me. Like, that's my psychology, is I can't not do it in the moment, because if I don't, I lose it.
Yes.
A project started will end up differently if you stop and take a break in the middle of it. You can't do that. I can't do that. And so, you know, henceforth, why creative people, I think people, creative people in routine, I mean, this is, don't people understand that this is why artists dye their hair purple and wear funny clothes sometimes in their youth? And, you know, some of them engage in psychedelic drugs and all that. Like, do people not understand that? That's what this is. It's the creative process. That is, it's the internal externalizing. And, you know, we've talked about Jeff Kripal before the program. This is what Jeff, you know, really talks about a lot, is the paranormal some amalgamation of an external and an internal that is becoming external by force of us? In other words, are we reaching out a hand and it's grabbing the hand? You know, and how much does the creative process play into these things? These are all things we have no idea. We have no idea what this means. Why does Discord bring this stuff in? The easy answer is, well, it's demonic. Nah, sorry, yeah. I'm not buying that. You know, this, but can you understand why people would say that's evil? You can understand this, you know? At some point when you understand the marginal aspects of this and you understand how the human behavior responds to the unknown and then how it reacts within the context of anti-structure and liminal states and marginal people and places, then you understand hoaxes. Like, hoaxes used to burn me up, right? Because they'd waste my time. Give me a photograph, do an exam on it, it's a hoax. I'm just aggravated, it's a waste of my time. Well, now I go, such things are completely to be expected. I completely expect hoaxes. I completely expect people to lie. You know, I had a guy just last week show me an orb photograph that was clearly a dust particle. I mean, so clearly that I could compare it to any dust particle anyone would show me. And he says, well, I saw that with my naked eye. It was as big as a bowling ball. I was like, no, see, just because you say that, that I'm not inclined to believe that because of what you're showing me. If you would show me video of you chasing this thing through the tree, then I go, okay, we got something going on here. Now, people embellish a lot. And I don't know how people do that. Because for me, I'm not going to sit here and lie to everybody and say, have I ever thought of trying to make the story more interesting? And I go, well, why? Why? It's already ridiculously unbelievable. It's already interesting enough, you know, but how do I become heard for this? Because I feel like this is important, but the temptation is to say, well, I make up some story. Do you know what this phenomena I believe would do to me if I did that? I fear this thing. No, I'm not kidding. I mean, it's funny on some level, but I fear this, and I fear what would happen if I did lie about it or even embellish it. Like,
I would think if anything, you'd be tempted to tone it down, make it
fit
better with what people expect.
I think there was the temptation to do that in the beginning. But then I kind of recognized, like, no, this bizarre thing, this needs to be talked about because nobody's talking about this. And yet in private, everybody opens up about it. Like every experiencer I've ever met, I know it's beyond weird. And the self-negation aspect of it, I think that's a major clue with all of this. Like, I don't think it's just marginality. I think there is an active component of this thing that says, like Jacques Vallée said, you know, to report this with 100% honesty is to be thought a fool. You can't talk about this. I don't know how familiar with Terrence McKenna's stuff that you are.
Somewhat.
I mean, people widely consider him like the godfather of the mushroom, the psychedelic mushroom and all of that. And yeah, he is all those things, and he's a botanist, and he was incredibly smart, incredibly well read, but he was also very intrigued by the UFO subject. And he drew parallels between psychedelic experiences and the UFO experiences. And there are some. It is in some ways a psychedelic kind of thematic going on. The very bizarre aspect to it is there. And as somebody who never took drugs in my life, he was partially one of the big reasons I said, yes, I'm going to eat a magic mushroom. I'm going to see what that's like, because I want to know, is that like what I experienced as a kid? Is that what this is? And the answer was no. The answer was, you know, it's like, I know a lot of people get real insight from it. I got insight like, I never want to do that again. but he had an experience in the Amazon. They were researching and experimenting with psychedelic compounds there. And one morning, he describes it as being lightly intoxicated on mushrooms. He said, to my credit, he says, I was familiar with all hallucinogenic drugs and their effects. So I know what a hallucinogenic property is on my psyche. I know what to expect. This was not that. And he then described this UFO sighting that he had where he saw the Adamski flying saucer coming through the air. Such things are nonsense because we all know that photograph is hoaxed. It's proven, demonstrable. Right? Long before it was discovered what the parts were made from, computer analysis said it's nonsense. But yet there it was for him. And so that's an experience. And I've had that reported to me by other people, even locally. One man had a tractor trailer floating over his home, over his barn, rather. Lights, tanker truck, the whole bit. It was there. His family, they all saw it. It was there. Another woman reported an upside-down Star Trek Enterprise over a field. I mean, this stuff does get reported. People have reported TIE fighters. You know, I mean, these kinds of things do happen. But these are experiences that you're not, I mean, the average person is not inclined to talk about these in public.
Well, sure, because they sound so ludicrous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, well, you know, my thing is, okay, well, you know, here's what I photographed in my hallway. It ain't much, but it's interesting. And so if we try to engage this, will it respond or won't it? And I don't know. I have a good feeling it might. And if it doesn't, we try something else. Either way, there's something going on here.
And where can people find the project again?
That is at GoFundMe.com, and it's a slash, and then it's Project Oculus. And it sounds just like it sounds. It's spelled just like it sounds, rather. Oculus. O-C, oh, God. Here I go. O-C-U-L-U-S? Oculus?
I believe so.
Okay. Getting late. But yeah, that's where you can find. And again, if you go to GoFundMe.com and search paranormal, I come up. It'll be somewhere on one of those pages. You'll find it. And you know, you can go to ParatopiaOculus.com, and there's a link there in the show description for this week. There's a link there. But we'll see what happens. You know, I'm really encouraged by the feedback that I've gotten so far. We've got some enormous donations, which is like beyond anything I expected. I really didn't expect it to take off like it has. But we're well on our way.
Cool.
And so, you know, we could use one last push to kind of get us over a hurdle, and then we can start getting stuff going here.
All right, there you go. That was part one. Part two will be next week. As I said, there are three parts. And if you're a patron, you got them all in one big chunk already. And if you want to become a patron, just go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. It's only $3 a month. You get extra bits. There'll be an extra bit from Jeff, as well as full interviews when they're pre-recorded like this, and I have to split them in the parts because, you know, we talked for about 3.5 hours and could have gone longer. All right. Anyway, we're going to close out here with some music from a band called the John Stickley Trio. And Micah Hanks actually made me aware of this by playing them on the Grailian Report. And for those of you in the upstate New York area, I believe this band will be playing at Grassroots this year. So if you like it, go check them out. This is a song called Point to Point. See you next week. We'll be right back.